This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Hello and welcome to Working Like Dogs on Pet Life Radio. Thank you for joining us. We're your hosts. My name is Marcy Davis, and my co-host is my amazing service dog, Fenway. And we're so excited to be with you today to talk about our favorite subject, working dogs and working animals. And today we have two guests for the show. We are welcoming Dr. Simone Seidel and J.C. Gantenberger from the University of Denver's Institute for Human-Animal Connection. And Dr. Seidel is a practicing veterinarian. She received her BA in biology from the University of Rochester in 2006 and her Doctor of Veterinary Medicine from St. George's University School of Veterinary Medicine in 2011. And J.C. Gantenberger is a research associate with the Institute for Human-Animal Connection at the University of Denver. And she earned her MSW from the University of Denver Graduate School of Social Work in 2019. And she also holds a MA, a master's degree, in Middle East Studies from the University of Oklahoma in 2014. So these two incredible women have a new publication out from the Institute for Human-Animal Connection on recognizing and mitigating canine stress in human-canine interaction research. So I am super excited to hear about their groundbreaking research and what they can share with us. So come right back after these quick messages as we welcome Dr. Seidel and J.C. Gantenberger to the show.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Working Like Dogs on Pet Life Radio. Hello, Dr. Seidel and JC. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, I'm so excited that you two could be with us, and I'm so anxious to hear about the research that you're doing. So before we get into all that, though, JC, can you tell our listeners a little bit about the Institute for Human-Animal Connection? What makes your institute unique, and what all kinds of really amazing stuff is happening at the Institute?
Sure. That's a big question. Because I'm really proud of the Institute and the work that we're doing. So as you said, we're at the University of Denver, and we are housed in a school of social work, which is really unusual. So there's a few institutes like this out in the world that look at our relationships with the non-human animals, but they're usually in veterinary medicine. And while, of course, that's an incredibly important perspective, we bring more of the human side, the human orientation to our questions about how we impact each other. And so we offer a whole suite of educational offerings, some for Masters of Social Work students, some for working professionals, related to how we can incorporate animals into all kinds of work, social work, psychotherapy, occupational therapy, lots of different human service spaces. And then we also do research, which is the realm that I work in with the Institute, trying to understand how our relationships with animals affect our mental health and also whole community well-being.
I love it. That is so cool. What a fun job, JC, that you have.
Isn't it amazing sometimes that we get paid for doing these things?
Oh, yeah. Barely believe it.
I know. That sounds so cool. Well, tell me about, and whichever one of you wants to jump in and answer this, and maybe both of you, tell me why this research, why now? What brought you to this project?
Oh, gosh. So the true answer is, so I'm a veterinarian, and I'm actually sitting my specialty boards in October for the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists. So it's a specialty. It's essentially, I kind of equate it to a psychiatrist. Medical doctor, psychiatrist is the equivalent, I guess I would say. And so I previously knew Kevin Morris, who's the executive director of the foundation, and I needed to do a paper. They had, JC had previously published a paper on the impact of having your pet dog with you during an acute stress experience. And they had done a wonderful job of taking into account the dogs as individuals in that study. And so as part of my specialty program, I need to publish research. And I thought this was a particularly fun project because, as JC said, she's on the research side of things and I'm on the veterinary side of things. They both see things differently, but putting them both together was really kind of magic, in my opinion, because we got both the input of the researchers, which is they're looking at, you know, for example, in the human stressor paper, what is the impact of having your pet dog with you when you're exposed to some type of stressor event? And me as a veterinary behaviorist am always concerned about the impact of stress on animals, in this case, particularly dogs. And so we took the data from their original paper and pulled out information to essentially come up with a recommendations for researchers and how they can incorporate and account for the stress of dogs that are in these types of studies, because currently there is not anything that oversees this very niche place where dogs might be used.
Yeah.
Or incorporated, wow. I should say, really.
Tell us, JC, what outcomes were you measuring in this study? What were you looking at? For signs, or as you were saying, looking at anxiety and some of those things for those clinical pieces. Tell us about those outcomes you were measuring.
Sure. So just to give a little more background on the study too. So we took about 40 people who had pet dogs who agreed to come and let us kind of stress them out. And
that must have been an interesting group. Yes, yes.
They let us stress them out and take their blood. So, I mean, these are
much more generous people than I am.
Yeah. So we randomly asked about half of them to come with their dog and half of them to leave their dog behind at home. And so as you might guess, we were really curious about whether we saw differences in the two groups. Does having your dog with you impact how you respond when we stress you out? And so we collected blood and saliva samples and also had them fill out a survey at a few different points about their stress levels. And we tracked their heart rate continuously the entire time they were there. So the stressful event itself was pretty mean. We had them stand in front of a group of people in white lab coats carrying clipboards who didn't give any kind of verbal or nonverbal feedback while our participants were asked to give a brief public speech and then to do some mental math out loud. So something for everybody, right?
I was going to say, you threw the kitchen sink in there for what would stress you out. Getting your blood taken, public speaking, everything that makes our hair stand up.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So, yeah, really intense experience, but luckily it was over pretty quickly. But we looked at that blood, saliva, heart rate surveys just before. We put them through that immediately afterwards, and then about 45 minutes later. So that was the other question we wanted to see, was whether having your dog with you helped you like come out of that stress state maybe a little faster. And so in the blood and saliva, among other things, we were looking at cortisol and we were looking at alpha amylase, which is a similar marker of stress in that you typically expect it to go up when people are stressed and down when they're calmer. But it measures a different stress pathway, which I won't get really into the weeds of that, but basically just gives us a more comprehensive picture of what's happening. And so what we found with heart rate and cortisol is about what we had predicted, that Everybody saw it go up when we stressed them out and down afterwards. But the people with their dog had less of a spike and more of a cortisol recovery at the end. So having your dog with you seemed to help. The alpha amylase actually really surprised us. So for the people who showed up without their dog, they had essentially no alpha amylase response. It stayed flat, which might sound like a good thing, but you do want to have a reaction when you feel like you're under threat, when there's some kind of danger. Otherwise, you're dissociating, you're numbing out, you're actually, in some cases, showing an extreme stress response. So the people without the dog, flat response, not a good thing. People with their dog had more of a balanced response where it went up and then it went down. So overall, we saw that kind of across the board, across this comprehensive set of stress measures, that the people with the dog had what we sometimes call a Goldilocks response, not too high, not too low, but more healthy, more balanced. But then exactly like Dr. Seidel was saying earlier, when we were designing the study, we had almost no guidance on how do we ethically, thoughtfully incorporate these dogs, because we want to stress out the people. We don't want to stress out the dogs. We want them to be as okay as possible for their well-being, for everybody's safety. And we were lucky to have a really amazing team with us, including a canine behaviorist and some others who were able to give us a lot of insights into how to approach it thoughtfully. But it really was just talking to people and thinking hard about the study and trying to put something together. So the goal of this more recent publication was really to say, here's what we did, why? Here's what we think we could do better next time. And we hope other people build on this, that we're really trying to start a conversation rather than say, like, we figured it all out. Here you go. Just do exactly this and nobody has to think about it again.
That's amazing. I mean, this is so groundbreaking of what you're looking at. And I hope that eventually, if you also be looking at the dog's stress levels and how soon they calm down, that would be really interesting. As a service dog handler, that's the one thing I'm always looking at with Fenway is, what is his stress level? What is my stress level? And what is his stress level? So that when we're in situations that are anxiety provoking, as we all experience, of how to really work through that in a healthy way.
So that is actually what we're doing next. So we have a study that's underway right now looking at specifically military veterans with PTSD who have service dogs. And we're following both the veterans and the dogs over time to see how everyone's stress, well-being. Yeah, yeah. So we'll have to keep updated on that.
Yeah, well, we want to hear those results. Well, I'm guessing all these were adults that you were working with?
Or
mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah. So that, what was the criteria to participate, and how did you recruit people?
Yeah. So they needed to be adults. We were transparent, not about the details of what to expect for the stressor, but that we would be stressing them out, that it would have 3 blood draws. So we did ask them to kind of self-screen for, whether they felt like they would be up for that. And on the dog side, we had a series of questions that we asked them to fill out to respond to in advance so that we could assess if the dogs were likely to be a good fit for the study. So we let them know things like, this was all taking place in scientific lab. So while they are diligent about sanitation, you never quite know what might be on the floor. So is your dog likely to start licking strange substances on the ground? Mm-hmm. Or is that something you can manage? They'll be around a set of strange people who won't be interacting with them. They'll need to take stairs to the elevator because it was up on the 5th floor. We had a whole list of things like that, that, again, we wanted them to let us know, like, based on how well you know your dog, would they be up for this or not? And if you're not sure, let's hop on the phone and talk about it, essentially.
Nice. And there were 40 of these individuals. And how many actually had dogs with them? Was it half and half?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Wow. Well, that sounds so cool. And what were some of the biggest takeaways that you got from this? I mean, you mentioned a couple, but what really did you see as some of those major breakthroughs? Dr. Seidel, if you want to answer that, yeah, go ahead. Please.
I would like Jason can answer the, she was the leader of the human stressor paper. And then I came in with a secondary study of proposing the guidelines of how we can reduce stress for dogs that are in these types of studies. So I'll let JC answer the, what was the takeaway from the the primary study, which I think is incredible.
Sure. So like I said, we saw this really interesting difference between the two groups in terms of their stress response. And actually, interestingly, it ties to the PTSD study that I mentioned that we're doing next, in that with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, you see both hyper-reactivity to stress and hypo-reactivity. So sometimes big, explosive responses when you're stressed out, hypervigilance, a lot of intensity, and sometimes checked out, dissociated, numbing. So our participants for this study, to our knowledge, none of them had PTSD, but we do think there's some really interesting implications that if dogs can help you stay in that balanced place, that that may be a painting a picture for how they can help a whole range of people. We also did try for the study to look at the dog's stress levels as well by collecting saliva samples. Unfortunately, that didn't work out the way that we had hoped. And Dr. Siddle, you might be able to expand some on why that was.
And I would say, so for the secondary study that we wrote in terms of trying to build guidelines for other researchers doing similar human-canine interaction studies, we found out that it's actually quite difficult to get data on dogs without stressing them out. So things like, just like us, things like collecting blood would be the most ideal. It would give us the most information in terms of markers like cortisol or alpha amylase, et cetera. But, you know, as we know, most dogs, that's very stressful. And even salivary sample collection, unless it's somebody who like a veterinarian or a veterinary technician who is very accustomed to this type of thing, that itself can be stressful. One of the things that I thought was really interesting from our secondary study, and again, I kind of came in later in the game here, was that JC and the team did a really extraordinary job, and that very few of the dogs had extremely elevated behavioral observational stress levels. So they did a very good job in terms of screening for good candidates, not only in the humans, but in the dogs as well as creating a study environment that minimized the stress as much as possible. And so I think the take-home point for the secondary study for me, and I think for us and for the community at large, particularly the research community, is that without much effort, you can really take into account the stress that you're putting these dogs under during these types of studies, which are particularly or specifically volunteer-based studies. So people who volunteer for the studies with their dogs, bringing to light that the dogs didn't volunteer for the study, the people did. And so we want to be ethical and mindful of that, and that really they did a fantastic job of doing that. And it allowed us to create this secondary study to create guidelines, like JC said.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because I really want to hear. This is so fascinating. And I can't wait to hear about your proposed guidelines and recommendations. So let's just take a quick break and hear some important messages from our sponsors who we love. And we will come right back and continue our conversation. So come right back.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Working Like Dogs on Pet Life Radio. We're visiting today with veterinarian Dr. Siddle and researcher J.C. Gandenberger from the University of Denver Institute on Human-Animal Connection. And we're visiting about the really amazing, groundbreaking work and study that they have just released and some of the future studies that they're doing. And Dr. Seidel, you were telling us about some of the outcomes and you were starting to talk about the proposed guidelines that you developed as a result of this research. So tell us a little bit more of those guidelines and recommendations for future ethical studies and just what those guidelines are.
Yeah. So when going through the literature in preparing for this paper, what I found is that there are thankfully a number of studies on how to reduce stress or recognize or mitigate stress for dogs that are in human assisted type positions. So therapy dogs, service dogs, et cetera. Education dogs versus guidelines for like I said, dogs that are the humans decided to volunteer for a study, but the dog didn't decide to volunteer. Or for people who, you know, there's a lot of people out there who have dogs who are their pet dogs. They may not be like official emotional support dogs, but a lot of people get emotional support from their dogs and take their dogs a lot of places because they provide them a lot of comfort, et cetera. And so the goal of this particular study was how to recognize and mitigate stress for dogs that are in human-canine interaction studies. So this is different from human-assisted intervention studies where the dog is intended to do a particular job or therapy dogs, things like that. And so what we really wanted was to create guidelines for, like I said, this very kind of like niche research setting for researchers out there and to give them a place to start. And again, to even bring up the thought and conversation of the dog in these studies are sentient beings. They're their own individuals. They have their own experiences. They have their own emotions. And that we really want to take that into account rather than just consider them an object in a study. We really want to recognize them as individuals.
And what would you say, based on your findings, what would you recommend that clinicians should use tomorrow in their research?
Yeah.
And what's that reality? The clinical reality for researchers.
Yeah. That's a great question. So I think some of the really big take-home points were for me, and JC, you're welcome to jump in as well, of course. But for me, I think some of the big take-home points in the places where the original human stressor study really prevailed and really succeeded was the original screening process. So giving people the opportunity to recognize, is their dog going to be a good candidate for the study? Do they think their dog is going to be stressed out by it? And then simple things like trying to make the study environment as dog friendly as possible. So they did things like provided a dog bed, made sure that surfaces weren't too slippery or that dogs had access to non-slippery surfaces like a yoga mat. There was fresh water. I'm trying to think what the next. So making sure that the study environment itself, we're looking at it from the dog's eye view, so to speak.
For comfort and absolutely. All of those things that are on our minds as effective handlers. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And then I think the biggest thing, and this is going to be my push home point, not just for researchers, but for anybody out there who owns a pet dog, would be understanding canine body language and dog body language. And so in this study, we used something called the Fear-Free Fear, Anxiety, and Stress Score, which is something you can get online for free. There's images. It tells you the body language of dogs going from calm all the way up to a dog that's lunging and biting you. Thankfully, we did not get any of those in the study. We didn't even get remotely close to that. But I think one of the most important take-home points is that dogs communicate all the time. And the problem is that humans just don't speak their language. And so unless you put a little bit of effort into understanding their language, we miss signs from them all the time that they're stressed. And so, again, from my point of view as a veterinarian, not as a researcher, for researchers who are out there, but also can be extended to anybody out there who has a pet dog and who takes them places and things like that, being aware of their body language and recognizing low-level signs of stress so that you can intervene sooner, which in this study, there were two dogs that were excluded due to stressor signs. And so instead of pushing those dogs and putting them in a potentially dangerous situation for the dog and the people, the research team was able to intervene and remove them from the study. So, yeah.
Yeah. And tell us again, where did you say that canine body language tool is?
So it's called Fear Free. I think the website is fearfree.com. I think I'll have to double check that, but I think it's Fear Free. And so Fear Free is, I'm not affiliated with them, but they are a big name in terms of a place where you can take online courses. And they have online courses for pet owners or guardians. They have online courses for veterinarians and veterinary staff. They have online courses for groomers, pet sitters. At some point in the future, I will probably advocate to potentially have them create a course for actually researchers. And so it's courses that you can take online to learn things like canine body language, how to reduce stress, and things like that.
Yeah, that would be so helpful for so many people. Yeah, especially people too that are doing the owner trained service dog training for their own dogs. That would be so helpful for them. Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that yep. tool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, JC, I have a question for you. If you were advising a new program that is just starting a new service dog program, based on the research that you've been doing, what would you make mandatory around handler education, welfare metrics, and data collection for those agencies? What would you suggest?
That's a fascinating question.
You guys can tell how much I love this subject. I'm thinking about it all the time.
Yeah. Well, I think one piece goes back to Dr. Siddell. I'm going to steal your language, thinking from the dog's eye view. So my background is as a social worker, right? So I've learned from the generosity of others who have a lot more training than I do about dogs. But I feel like I was able to pretty naturally think about this area will be loud. This area might have food on the floor. But understanding that dogs have a very different sensory experience of the world than people do, and not just being able to like think about, okay, what stands out from my lens, was really key. And as one example, I learned in my preparation for this study that dogs can smell lingering scents associated with fear from other dogs. And so if you imagine their experience of participating in this study, showing up with their person who probably is nervous even when they first show up because they don't know what to expect. They're in a strange place with strange people who are interacting with them oddly. And then they go to the place that we start out with all of these human dog pairs. And all the dog can smell is other dogs have been here and they were scared. That sounds like the start of a horror movie to me, to be. And so we were able to do some things like use specific cleaning products and an air filter that helped clear out those scents so that wouldn't be their first experience. But for example, standard cleaning products don't erase those smells because they're made for people and we're not thinking about non-human animals' experiences. So that's one of many examples where if you're not coming in with a certain amount of knowledge and understanding, you're not going to be able to just mentally picture your there. So that would be probably the biggest arena of training that I would want to be sure that handlers got. And then on the data collection side, I mean, as a researcher, I want all of it. But certainly, well, for our study, we're using the CBARC. Oh, and now I'm going to have to tell you what that stands for. The Canine Behavioral Assessment for Research Questionnaire.
Did nice. I get it? See, I think you did.
I guess pretty close, Canine.
Yeah, that's good enough. Yes.
Research yes. questionnaire, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Which is also cool. A free tool that can be used by just about anyone. You don't need specialized training to fill it out. But it's a series of questions related to your dog's signs of stress and anxiety. So that's one of the things that we're following over time. But I think not only does it help us as researchers learn a lot about dogs, but it can also help handlers just be clued in to hear some things to think about and pay attention to over time. And perhaps if you're seeing signs of concern, you might be prompted to respond, to dig in, to figure out how to help them a little more quickly than if you're not being primed to look at all of the different categories that are collected there.
Yeah, I love that you're making this so accessible for everyone. Because as a service dog handler, that was my training, as I've been trained over all these decades now of living and working with a service dog, my awareness is heightened. So when I go into a room, I'm scanning for anything that's going to be a barrier, or like you said, food on the floor, smells on the floor for Fenway, anything that might cause him discomfort or stress. So I just love that you're expanding that so that other people can start to have that awareness, because it really is a different mindset of when we're thinking about these environments for ourselves and our animals, our dogs.
It really is. And I think, you know, my hope for the world would be that not only service pet handlers, but honestly, all
exactly everybody. Yes.
I say all the time in my line of business, I have almost stopped going to things like beer gardens and dog parks even. Mm-hmm. My mentor taught me the term behavior goggles. And once you have behavior goggles on, you can't take it off. And so once you learn the body language of dogs that are stressed, you start everywhere. And especially places like breweries or patios where it's dog friendly, you see these dogs that are so stressed and you're like, your dog doesn't want to be here.
Exactly.
Like,
I know.
Your dog wants to be home on the couch, you know?
Yes, that's right. I see that so much, and it breaks my heart, and it's super frustrating. Yes, yes. Because if these dogs aren't conditioned or prepared for that, in fact, last night, my husband and I were having dinner and he started washing dishes and he knocked over an aluminum bowl. And Fenway was, of course, laying next to me and he never flinched. I jumped.
Yeah.
You know, it scared me. But Fenway, because of his training, he's so conditioned to loud noises that he was like, oh, it's cool. Dad dropped it. He's got it. Yeah. So, but when you're not, yes, yes.
The work that goes into service dogs is just so impressive.
Years and years.
I mean, yeah. Or honestly, any working dogs, you know.
Yes.
Police dogs and military dogs and, you know, all of these working dogs that, the work that goes into them is really incredible.
Yeah, they have to be able to handle high levels of stress.
Yeah.
But I'm just so thrilled that you're expanding that so that other people can start to create their awareness of those stress levels. Well, I could talk to you two all day. This is so exciting what you're doing, and I can't wait to hear about the next study and definitely want you to come back. But before you have to leave us, I want you, JC, if you could just tell us how people can get more information about the Institute and anything you want to share about what's coming up at the Institute, please.
Sure. So the best way to get more information is to go to du.edu/IHAC, which is IHAC. And there you can find information about our education, our research, links to our studies. You can also join our email list, which will keep you up to date around upcoming events. So among other things, several times a year, we have guest speakers from other spaces doing work that we really love and respect come and speak and share what they're thinking about. And we speak at conferences and share out our own research findings. So lots of ways to get involved in person or remotely. And we're actually coming up on the 20th anniversary of our institute, which we're very excited.
Congratulations.
About.
Oh, 20
you.
Years already.
Yeah. 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 No. And it was really the vision of our founder, Phil Tedeschi, the original executive director, who saw so early on the desire for us to tap into our connections with non-human animals and the power of those relationships. So much respect to him for starting us out and for Kevin Morris for continuing it from there. But anyway, we'll be having some celebrations and other events coming up that we would love anybody who's interested to be a part of.
Fenway and I love following your social media, so we keep an eye on what you're doing. And your founder was on our show earlier.
Oh!
Yeah, so we have been thrilled to have him. Yes, yes. So we just love and really respect and appreciate all the wonderful work that you're doing, both through your research and then what the Institute is doing with all the other activities. So thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Marcy. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yes.
Well, it was so fun. Thank you.
Thank you both. And I definitely will put some of these wonderful links that you've shared with us today about these tools, because these are fantastic tools that everyone can benefit from. So we will definitely make that available. And we want to thank you, our listeners, for being with us today. We love it for you to join us. And we love to hear from you. So please keep your comments and thoughts coming. And you know you can email Fenway and I at Marcie, M-A-R-C-I-E, at PetLifeRadio.com. I also want to share some exciting news. I've been working on a brand new children's book called Humphrey, the Hopeful Helper. It's a heartwarming story of a little yellow lab puppy with big paws and an even bigger dream to become a service dog. And this beautifully illustrated book is coming soon, and I can't wait to share Humphrey's adventures with you and your family. So be sure to join our mailing list at workinglikedogs.com so you'll be the first to know when Humphrey the Hopeful Helper is released. I promise you don't want to miss this one. So thanks so much for being with us, and we look forward to being with you again soon. Take good care.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.